Good morning. A couple of weeks ago, I had somebody requested that I would do a lesson on comparative religions, and they asked if I would talk about Islam, which I'd never done a lesson on. So I put together as much as I could say in 30 minutes and talked about that a little bit, and probably left as many blanks in your mind as I did, filled in a few gaps. I did correct a statistic that I mentioned when I gave you an estimate of the number of Muslims in the United States. It really, I was surprised when I looked it up. There's a lot of different surveys, a lot of different efforts to decide how many there are. It ranged from 1 million to 12 million. A lot of those were biased, didn't use good calibrators to figure that. It seemed like more, as I looked at it again, one of the more reasonable numbers was between 5 and 7. But that's you know, who can identify that exactly? So I thought about, after I did that lesson, had another person request that maybe talk a little bit about another religion that I knew less about than I knew about Islam, which is Buddhism. And so I tried to read a little bit about that and look at a few books and see if there were some things I could find that might be helpful. And these things are practical. I look back to my lessons of the last 20 years and I couldn't find a single lesson on Buddhism. So these aren't things that usually we talk about. If there's a relevance, it's because there are Buddhists and there are lots of Muslims and there are people of different faiths in this country. And we have some obligation, especially you in the workforce. You have to work with them. And knowing about them is helpful when we have opportunities to teach them and address those things. So it's very valid to study and to think about them. Though thinking about Jesus Christ as the way and knowing His way and the truth is most important, because then we know how to best approach and what they need. But I did try to find a few things out that might be helpful. I guess the best place I thought might be to start was really with Hinduism, because really Hinduism gave birth to Buddhism. Hinduism has been around since the 1500s before Christ. Buddhism didn't start to around 560 B.C., but one sort of grew out of the other. The Hindus had a caste system, kind of a hierarchy in India, and it was the priests were the highest caste, and then there was the warriors and the rulers below them, and then there was the merchants and landowners that were below them, and then the peasants were the lowest class. And that system existed in India. And, of course, also in their system, there was the idea of reincarnation, which is the idea that when something dies, its soul is then reborn into another life, and then that life may be a form, maybe a man or an animal, depending on how you lived in this life. And they use the word karma, very common in Hinduism. The deeds that you do in this life, the way you live in this life, affects the kind of form that you come back in the life to come. And so if you're an evil person in this life, you're probably going to be born into a lower caste. You might be a dog, you might be a flea, depending on how you live. And there were some consequences to that system of living over the course of the years. Consequences that were not good. It produced actually a lot of poverty in India, a very poor nation, because in the caste system, in that way of thinking, you can't do anything in this life to change your caste. You're born into as a peasant, and you're going to stay a peasant the entirety of your life. And so there was no motivation to change. People accepted poverty rather than trying to work to escape it. And also, because of this idea of rebirth and being reborn into different forms, that made everything sacred. Every animal and every insect, they were sacred in some sense. I think bulls and cows are more sacred, but you didn't kill anything, even harmful creatures. So India, as I read, tended to be overrun by animals and rats, and it produced more disease, had more negative effects on the society, and sickness. Evidently, by the 6th century, there was a number of people who were in some movements that were dissatisfied with the Hindu caste system and the Brahmin priests. And among these was led by a young man named Gautama Siddhartha. and I don't know if that's pronouncing it right, but he was a son of a ruler in one of these castes, an upper caste. And his story, I'll kind of recount for you briefly the story of this young man. The Buddha was not a god. He was this young man named Gautama. And he was, they say he was born around 560, but if you do a little bit of research about that, you're going to find that there's a variation in when he, they're not really sure, could be a 300-year difference in estimates of when he was born. There's just, because at some point it becomes more legend, lots of myths and legends involved in it. But most agree that he was born around 560, 563 B.C., and the story goes he was a prince, he was the son of one of these, of a ruler in this upper caste. And his dad adored him so much that he tried to shield him in the court from all of the ugliness and the horrific things that happened in the real world. And he banished all human suffering from the court. And so this young man grew up in this wonderful paradise, sort of. And he became very intellectual, very strong physically. And he finally married his cousin when he was 16 years old. And several years later, as the story goes, he discovered that life wasn't really so pleasant as what he had thought. He decided to go out on a chariot ride and see the towns. And so he went on four different chariot rides. And when he went through the first time, he encountered a sick man and was overwhelmed by the pain and the suffering of an old man who was very old. And then on his second ride through town, he encountered a sick man. And then the third ride, as he went around town, he encountered a dead man, somebody, or at least a funeral procession. He happened upon a funeral procession. And then the fourth ride, as he went through town, he encountered a beggar monk. But this man was very happy. He was a beggar. He looked very poor and poverty-stricken, but he had a big smile on his face. It's serene, happy, and so he kind of shocked him. Well, all this disturbed him a lot, so he went back to his home, and he thought, you know, if life is so full of sorrow, what's the use of living? But the beggar man had told him, this holy monk, this guy he had encountered at the end, had said, well, the best way to escape this sorrow is to become a monk yourself, become a beggar, just like me. So he goes back home, back to his court, and the first thing he finds is his wife has given birth to his firstborn son. And he starts, you know, that's exciting. He starts telling her about his experiences on these chariot rides, and she's not very impressed by that. She's not very interested in that. And so he leaves her. They're sleeping, wife's sleeping, baby's sleeping, and he just leaves, takes his stuff and he leaves. And he decides he's going to go in search of enlightenment, understanding this pain and suffering in life and how to escape it. So he trades in, takes the advice of this priest, this monk, beggar monk, and he trades in his silk robes for a suit of bark. And he rids himself of his chariot and his chariot driver, and he spends 6 years just wandering around, fasting, doing without all the physical comforts of life, and he nearly dies. Man, he's so malnourished, they said he was just a skeleton. But at the end of 6 years, he comes to realize he hasn't gained any more understanding of existence and the way out of sorrows than he had to begin with. So he sort of sits down under this tree, this Bodhi tree, I don't know how you pronounce that. But he sits down under this tree and starts thinking. And he says, well, I tried the rich life. I was wealthy. I didn't find any enlightenment there. And I tried the poor, abject poverty way. He said, there's nothing there. I didn't find any solution there. So I think it must be the middle way. It's got to be right down the center. That's where the path to understanding is. So he began to think the middle way is the way to where you achieve enlightenment. And enlightenment is a word that you have to put in your vocabulary if you want to talk to somebody who's a Buddhist. Very important idea in their mind. And it is the idea of being able to release yourself from this existence, the process of birth and life and death and then rebirth. And the idea is you need to get out of that. You need to release yourself from that condition And if you can do that, if you can escape from that predicament, you enter into a state that's normally called by Buddhist nirvana. That's there. That's where you end up. And a little bit more about enlightenment. I read that enlightenment sort of comes when you realize that yourself is an illusion. You have to kind of hang on to this, because this is a philosophy, it's a religion, it's a philosophical type religion, not just, it's not really based on concrete historical facts, it's more of a philosophy. But the idea is that when you're enlightenment is when you come to realize that yourself is an illusion. And one Zen Buddhist writer referred to enlightenment as the empty mirror. That suffering ends when you can understand that you are an illusion. You can look into a mirror and it's empty. And when you do that, you've achieved enlightenment. Not only are you free from suffering, but you've achieved nirvana. You won't be reborn into another life, but you've escaped into the bliss of nothingness. You have to kind of just understand the way the thinking is. Well, the name, going back to the idea of Buddha, this guy, they began to call him the Buddha because at the end of the 6 years, besides that rich and poverty is not the way, but this middle way, he's sitting under this banyan tree in this village. He's still begging for food. He's trying to recover his health now. And this girl comes out to this tree, and she brings this bowl of goat's milk, curds and goat's milk. And she comes to this tree because she's supposed to offer this to the tree, the spirit of the tree. And here's this young man sitting under this tree, and she thinks he's the spirit of the tree. So he must look kind of strange. And she thinks he's the spirit, so she gives him the goat milk and the curds. And so he drinks it. And he throws a bowl in the river that's going by right near to him. And he says that the bowl floated upstream instead of downstream. And that was a sign. Again, this is not documented historical facts. This is couched in legends and myths. So there's not really concrete testimony and witnesses that can debate this and test it to see if this was a real miracle. It's just, this is what he said. And the bowl floated back upstream, and that was a sign to him that he really needed to stay at this tree until he had supreme enlightenment. And they began calling him the Buddha at that point. And Buddha simply means the enlightened one, the one who has reached this understanding. And he stays there for a few days. He achieves this goal of enlightenment, and then he decides he needs to preach a sermon. So he puts a sermon together. And he called it Setting in Motion the Wheel of Law. And he spoke it to his five companions, these five buddies of his that traveled around with him. And he told them about the two extremes, that's neither through riches or poverty that you achieve this understanding, but it's the middle way. And that's where you get to peace. And he presented four noble truths. One was that to live is to suffer. You're going to live in this life, it's full of suffering. Can't get away from it. Second thing he taught was the cause of suffering is our desire for pleasure and prosperity. We always want things. We're always trying to satisfy ourselves. We're self-seeking, pleasure-seeking, and that is the reason that we suffer so much. Number three, he said the way to get out of that, to escape from this suffering in this world and sorrow, is to rid yourself of desire. So that becomes a fundamental principle of Buddhism. You have to rid yourself of all this pleasure seeking and desire for things, and to free yourself from that desire, you have to follow a certain path. Follow the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. It's an 8-step process. So he preached that day, and then he revealed what that path was. He had to tell them what's that Eightfold Path that people have to travel, and this is it. You have to, it really falls under three different categories: wisdom, moral discipline, and mental discipline. It really is the three key elements of their life. And under wisdom, you have to have the right views and the right motivation. And in terms of moral discipline, you need to have the right speech and right conduct and right livelihood. And it's pretty they define that out for you. You got to have, you know, proper speech, not ugly speech, but the right kind of speech. Right conduct is very moral in its approach. Sexual immorality is not tolerated. No lying, no dishonesty, no stealing. You're to have a good, clean, moral character. The right livelihood, the kind of job that you ought to have is significant. It's a job by which you can help others. It's not going to be some type of occupation by which you're going to hurt somebody else. And they advocate mental discipline, very key to it. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, or right concentration. And that really involves a lot of time that's devoted to sitting and thinking and purifying the mind and getting a lot of self-control in the way you think, controlling your thoughts. And so he presented this as the way to reach enlightenment, to escape this world of sorrows. Well, let me talk about differences between this and Christianity just a little bit. Bring it a little bit closer to a practical level. It's different from Christianity. First, before I said there is no concept of sin, but first let me mention a couple of other things I thought of later or learned. First is the goal of a Buddhist is to escape the cycle of birth and life and death and rebirth, being born again, into a state of peace and really extinction. Eternity for a Christian, on the other hand, is a personal relationship with God that begins now by faith and continues after death by sight in a personal existence and relationship in the presence of God. They also have this belief in reincarnation, which is the difference between Christianity and Buddhism. The idea that you can be reincarnated as an animal. Many Buddhists believe they have to value life in its entirety, and they don't. Even some don't eat meat. No, some do. Don't get me wrong. Not all Buddhists do. Some think that if they don't cause the animal to die, they can partake of it. But they don't want to be accountable for the death of a relative who might be some type of animal. Obviously, Christianity does not have anything in its system of Jesus Christ that would indicate that there is a rebirth into this life. There's no concept of sin. You may make mistakes. You may make bad decisions. And you will pay the consequences. You may pay them now, or you may pay them in the next life if you live in a foolish way. But there's no idea of transgression of the law of a God in their system. Buddhists would say when Jesus and his disciples encountered the blind man in John chapter 9, and they said, "Who sinned, this man or his parents?" And Jesus said, "Neither." The Buddhists would say, "Well, both of them did. Not sin, but they both did something foolish in their last life. They're stupid, so they came back this way, and he's being punished now for the way he lived in the last life." They'd say the blind man deserved what he got. He's paying his dues for past thoughts and past actions. And he has to keep being reborn until his good deeds outweigh his bad deeds. I'd like to raise a question. If he had what about his first birth? What deeds did he? What was his evil before he was born the first time? I don't know how you work that out. It's a logical inconsistency. Although the man had had many rebirths according to Buddhism, he must have had a first birth. But what was his sin? Going to be reborn the first time? I don't know. I don't think they can answer that. They're sort of indifferent to the concept of God. Now, you might label them as atheists, but they would say, "No, we're not atheists. We're just indifferent to it. It doesn't matter to us. We have transcended that." When you see them bowing before an altar, they're not really worshiping a god. They're sort of pledging themselves to the concepts and the ideas of Buddhism. And obviously, if there's no sin, another thing that we learn is there's no need for a savior. Jesus is not a Savior as far as they're concerned. They don't need a Savior. And you don't. If you have no sin and you have no Savior, no sin, and you're not accountable to any God, then you also don't need salvation. The Buddha, at least in one of his stories, or the records, their documents, in a discussion with a young lady named Amanda, who was some helper to him, right before his death, he said this. Here's what he said. He said, "You must be your own lamps. Be your own refuges. Take refuge in nothing outside yourselves. Hold firm to the truth as a lamp and a refuge. And do not look for refuge to anything besides yourselves. A monk becomes his own lamp and a refuge by continually looking on his body, his feelings, his perceptions, his moods, and ideas in such a manner that he conquers the cravings and depressions of an ordinary man and is always strenuous, self-possessed, and collected in mind." So there's a kind of a revealing statement. You know, you hear people who look to, he said, look to yourself. This is where you find your help, your self-help. You find it within. That's where you turn. The Christian obviously turns outwardly. We look at ourselves and say we failed, and the solution to our problem is in someone else, not within, but that's where they see the solution is. They don't teach about heaven and hell. They don't teach that heaven and hell follows death. It's kind of just an endless cycle. You escape from this life into this state of nirvana, a state of not a place, but sort of almost a non-existence. And it's related back to Hinduism. I don't have time to talk about that because I don't know enough about it. But somehow it's still tied to some of the concepts of Hinduism and a universal spirit and being absorbed into this universal spirit. There are, interestingly, some similarities with Christianity and Buddhism. They see a great value in emptying themselves of worldly desires, and the great achievement in Buddhism is selflessness. The world's greatest worth is self-mastery, controlling yourself, what you do, what you say. The quality of seeking to serve others is in part of their teaching. The greatest precept, they say, is continual awareness. The greatest medicine is emptiness of everything. The greatest action is not conforming to the world's ways. They have the golden rule, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. Some of the ethical principles, in other words, are very similar to the principles in Christianity. The greatest patience is humility. The greatest effort is not to be concerned with results. And the greatest meditation is a mind that lets go. So, you know, in a sense, Buddhism kind of can merge very well with various societies. It merges right in. One of its chief attributes, from what I read, is its ability to mold itself to various cultures. One fellow who writes articles for a Buddhist magazine explained it this way. He said, whether one is a Hindu, a Muslim, a Christian, or a Buddhist, it doesn't matter. Everyone can practice this. That is this way that we've been talking about. Because this is the nature of the mind. The nature of everyone's mind. If you can get a handle on your mind and pacify it in this way, you will see the results in your daily life situation. So there's this ethical correlation in some respects between Buddhism and Christianity. And if I summarized it, just put it in a nutshell, I'd say Buddhism presents transformational goals, a desire to improve your situation, a distinct moral code. You're trying to transform yourself within. It's hard in one sense for me to call this a religion because they don't actually worship any God. It's more of a way of life, more of a philosophy of life. Though the more I read, there's many different branches, many different streams of Buddhism, and it changed. It went through different countries, and so it went through different transformations as it picked things up from different places. Buddha died at age 89, but the teaching spread. And actually, it almost died out in India because I think Hinduism didn't accept it or opposed to it. But it was appealing to a certain king in the 3rd century named Asoka. And his empire was sort of adjacent to the city of Nepal, the area where Buddha was. He began his reign with violence, but as he saw the horrific results, he decided, I think Buddhism's a better way. And so he stopped conquering things by war, and he began to spread the teachings of Buddha. And as it went out, it went down to Sri Lanka in the south, down at the bottom of the map there. And then it moved north to Tibet and China in the 1st century, and then to Korea in the 4th century, and I think to Japan in the 6th century. And if you look for estimates today of how many Buddhists there are in the world, I saw numbers kind of like maybe 365 million people in the world. Maybe 6% of the population of the world are Buddhists. And they called it, how do you know reality, but they say it was the 4th largest religion in the world. But there's so many variations of beliefs, it was just really impossible for me just to nail it down and say all of the things that they thought and believed, because Buddha did not believe in a strong, didn't have a real strong religious authority. In other words, he didn't have a body of doctrine that was absolute and was absolutely authoritative like other, like the Quran or the Bible. Then it was very flexible, and it sort of molded itself or modified itself to fit whatever culture it encountered. And he believed that as things changed, the religion should change. And somebody says, well, why are you telling me this? You know, why should it concern me? You know, well, it is here. I mean, it is in America, and maybe some here know individuals who are Buddhist. It's not that uncommon anymore. It arrived in the 1800s. It's been here since the Civil War. Some U.S. colonel went, you know, a lot of transcendentalists, I think they called them, back in the 1800s. And he went to Sri Lanka and adopted the practices and pledged his allegiance. And then by 1893, there was a World Parliament of Religions in Chicago that invited Buddhist nations, China and Japan and Thailand, to be there. So you kind of got a voice in America. By 1900, there was a publication called The Light of Dharma. Dharma is like the word for their teachings. By 1931, there was the first Zen Institute of America. The American Buddhist Society existed. And, you know, in 1974, I read an article that off a Buddhist website that spoke of a lot of dialogue between Buddhists and the Catholic Church out in Southern California. There's a real big effort in Southern California, the Unitarian Churches of California, to work to create a dialogue between Buddhists and Christians. And really their effort is to try to validate all religions. That's the way of American society. We want to tolerate all, validate all, see benefit and good in all things, and see if we can merge it and make it one instead of having diversity in religion. And so this was growing in the United States. How would you approach a Buddhist? Maybe some of you know someone. How would you approach him? Well, suggestion. You need to show love and respect and understanding to their individuals. They actually are very morally disciplined people. Respect many of the things we do. There's no reason to be unkind to someone in an effort to teach them. We need to speak to them about a personal God. And just like Paul did in Acts 17 when he went to Athens, and there are many gods, and he talked to them about a personal God, one true God. There's one that's near, one that's close, one that we need to give an account to, one that created every man. And they need to hear about sin. They need to hear about forgiveness. They need to hear that if there is a God and he has a law, that there's the possibility that they transgress that law, and the Bible teaches that that's what we've done. We've transgressed the law of God. We need to speak about sin and forgiveness, just like Peter spoke about that in Acts chapter 2 when he did the lesson on the day of Pentecost. They need to know that it was a resistance to this God in the first place that has led to suffering in this life. That's why there's suffering and sorrow in the life, is because we've rejected the God that created this world. We've transgressed his laws and his ways, and that's resulted in our present situation. A man named Peter Kreft wrote that there have only been two people in history who so astonished people that they asked not who are you, but what are you, a man or a God? And they were Jesus and Buddha. He then contrasted striking differences in his book between the two. Buddha's clear answer to this question was, I'm a man, not a god. He didn't claim to be deity. He just claimed to be a man, a teacher. But Jesus' clear answer was, I am both, the Son of Man and the Son of God. What a radical difference between the two. Buddha said, look not to me, but look to my Dharma, look to my teachings, and then look within yourselves to find the answer. Christ said, come unto me. I'm the one that will give you rest. Buddha said, be ye lamps unto yourselves. But Christ said, I am the light of the world. Radical difference in the two. Buddha said, would say that the self-focus and self-effort are the way to this state of non-existence or peace or nirvana. Jesus said, I am the way. I am the way, but not to some type of non-existence, but the way back to the Father. Buddha said that everything is an illusion. Nothing is real. Jesus said, I am real. I'm the truth. Buddha said, the road to peace is detachment. And Jesus said, I am the life. Radically attach yourself to me, and you'll find life in abundance and peace that passes all understanding. Maybe these are some things that might at least give you awareness of who they are and what their maybe their frame of mind is, frame of thinking. Again, it seems like it's a way of life more than a religion, but certainly it's been classified among the great religions. I think they don't call their temples anymore. They call them churches because it helps to bridge the gap, and people don't think of them as much as a cult as they do just a church. And so they're certainly worshipers, but it's not worshipers of the God that the Bible presents. So we need to introduce them to the God of the Bible and help them to know. Well, I hope that would be helpful to you. Maybe you can get your psalm books out this morning and open to the page that was selection 297, and we'll be singing that in just a moment. And we invite people to serve Jesus and to follow His way. And He was a historical man, and He did historical things, and there were plenty of witnesses and eyewitnesses that challenged what He did and tested the things He said, and He worked many miracles that demonstrated that He had the power to command, the right to call us to submit to His authority. And that's what we invite you to do, submit to Jesus Christ, because we are guilty of sin. We are guilty of breaking the laws of God. And the only solution to that problem is through Jesus Christ, who died for the forgiveness of our sins. Would you be a follower of Jesus Christ? Follow His way this morning? Why don't you do that while we stand and sing our song?
Okay,